The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Mompós, Bolívar, 6 hours south from Cartagena along the Magdalena River. And this is episode 340 of the Columbia Calling podcast. My very special guest this week is Kyle Johnson. He's an expert on Columbia. He's a researcher for the Conflict Responses Foundation. That's something he set up only a few months ago. But prior to that, he's been working for a lot of different intelligence, let's say, or factual research entities and organizations for more than 11 years here in Colombia. So he knows what he's talking about. And we're going to be talking about the issue of the massacres that have been taking place in Colombia in the last few weeks. August has been a dreadful, dreadful month. And so we've got the questions for Kyle Johnson, and he's going to give us some of the answers, and of course those answers which he can give, because there's so much unknown about what has been taking place here beyond the headlines and beyond the news reports. So we'll discuss that, of course, and the ugly specter of the possible recommencement of aerial fumigations of coca cultivations across the country. And of course, we'll ask him what are his thoughts on a possible Biden presidency or another Trump presidency. So whoever is in the White House, how will they be looking at Colombia? What will happen to Colombia under a Biden presidency or a Trump presidency? So very, very interesting episode in the pipeline for you. Before we hand it over to Emily Hart for the newscast, I'd like to take a thank you to all of you out there who've given your feedback on Emily's newscast, which I think have been totally excellent and very professional. In fact, they've been, you know, widely praised across the board. I get several messages a week about her newscast. So it's a great pleasure to have her on the show. And of course, her knowledge of Colombia as well and her journalism expertise on that. And yes, the most recent episode, 339, with Emma Louise Jay in the driving seat interviewing me, was incredibly popular, of course, due to Emma Louise herself and her wonderful way with words and the erudite manner in which she composes herself, and of course the questions she posed to me. So thank you everyone who's tuned into that episode and heard a little bit about what it's like to be in rural Mompós here, colonial Mompós, during quarantine. Anyway, enough from me. I'm going to leave you in the capable hands of Emily Hart, who will bring you this week's newscast. And then in the final segment, we'll be back with Kyle Johnson talking about the goings-on and the violence, the upturn in violence, it seems, here in Colombia. So thank you again, and don't go away.
I'm Emily Hart, and this is the news for Colombia Calling for the week of August 31st, 2020. Colombia was shaken by violence in August, with 7 massacres in the space of 2 weeks, 46 in 2020 so far. Investigations are underway, but so far defendants have only been put on trial relating to one of the recent massacres. This week, another social leader, John Montero, was murdered in the Cauca, as well as a demobilized FARC member, Jorge Ivan Ramos, in Bolívar, who had become a leader in local peace process implementation. Since the peace deal was signed in December 2016, more than 222 members of the FARC taking part in reintegration programs have been assassinated. Former President Álvaro Uribe remains under house arrest, facing 12 years in prison on charges of witness tampering and bribery. Last week, Uribe quit the Senate in hopes of having his case transferred from the Supreme Court to the prosecutor's office, which is under closer executive control and is likely to be friendlier to his case due to its proximity with the Centro Democratico Party, of which Uribe is founder and was, until last week, senator. The Inspector General has now publicly called for the investigation to be transferred, but the decision remains to be made. The situation is being monitored by the UN Special Rapporteur on the Independence of Judges and Lawyers. This isn't, however, the only justice Uribe could be facing. Colombia's former chief prosecutor, Eduardo Montealegre, has announced that he has handed evidence to the Supreme Court that Uribe was complicit in two massacres which occurred during his governorship of the Department of Antioquia. Montealegre has filed criminal charges along with a 93-page document regarding Uribe's complicity in the La Granja and El Aro massacres in the mid-1990s. The accusation is that Uribe, as government, knew what the paramilitaries, working in collaboration with Colombia's security forces, were going to do, and that he did nothing to prevent the atrocities. Uribe has been called to trial next month to testify on the new charges, on which he faces at least 30 years in prison. Added to the 12 of the former trial, the former president could be facing what amounts to a life sentence without parole. The Colombian government has yet again bungled a request to the USA to extradite former paramilitary chief Salvatore Mancuso back to Colombia. Mancuso was part of the leadership of the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, known as the AUC. Mancuso has now served 12 years in prison in the US for drug trafficking offenses. He may now stay there or even be sent to Italy, where he also has citizenship. This would be a huge blow for Mancuso's victims in Colombia. Due to his extradition to the USA, Mancuso never served a day in prison for the massacres and crimes against humanity for which he was responsible as a leader of the AUC. As part of the demobilization process, Mancuso confessed to 402 crimes in front of the Colombian justice system before he was extradited. These ranged from murder and forced disappearances to traffic and manufacture of narcotics. Mancuso's ongoing testimony could also help uncover the truth about hundreds of other crimes and ensure justice for thousands of victims. He remains an important figure because he has been one of the few former paramilitary chiefs to collaborate with the justice system. He's shed light on massacres like El Aro, for which former President Uribe now stands trial. There have now been four unsuccessful requests to US authorities for this same extradition, mostly due to a series of technical errors. It is suspected that this incompetence is not a coincidence. Green Party Senator Antonio Sanguino has stated unequivocally that a deliberate chain of errors is evident. The direct beneficiaries of these errors are the forces of Uribe and those close to him. And to Corona news, Colombia has now passed 19,000 COVID-19 deaths, recorded cases at over 600,000. Colombia is seeing a 3% mortality rate, but the peak of new cases seems to be passing. The number of new cases per day falling consistently since mid-August. Pressure is also easing on intensive care units, with capacities back at over 80% in most major cities. The lockdown, which has been in place since March 25th, will gradually be lifted in Bogotá and Medellín, starting on the 1st of September. Colombia has yet again announced its intentions to open international flights in the coming months, though has yet to release a solid timeline or plan. Avianca, the nation's airline, will be receiving a rescue loan of $370 million in order to continue operations. That was the week's news bulletin. Now back to Colombia Calling with Richard McCall.
And we're back. This is the final segment of the Colombia Calling episode 340. I'm here in Montbos. My very special guest this week is Kyle Johnson. We'll say he's a researcher at the Conflict Responses Foundation. He's been here in Colombia, well, back and forth since 2005, 2006. Been living here full time for 11 years. And, you know, well, one of the most quoted men when it comes to one of the most heinous and terrible things that have been taking place in Colombia this last few weeks. So we're going to talk to him and just get an explainer and an explanation of what's going on in Colombia at the moment. You know, you've seen the pieces in The Guardian, you've seen the pieces in the New York Times, you've seen the pieces on Reuters and the BBC. But there's only so far that they can go in, you know, the written article. So we're here with Kyle Johnson, and we're just going to say, you know, well, thank you so much for agreeing to be on this podcast.
No, thank you for the invitation. It's great to be here. Even if the topic isn't the happiest, but it's still great to be able to discuss it.
Yeah, well, we'll get you on at a later date to talk about thread counts in great hotels and you know, your favorite Colombian fruit and so on and so forth. But I mean, you've been here a long time. You've done work in various organizations and I mean, your heart seems very much embedded in Colombia. So, I mean, you really were quoted, and there was quite a I would say, impacting thread that you put on Twitter. I guess it was a week or so ago after we'd had several massacres, and yours was a response. It was in Spanish. I don't remember if you did it in English as well, but it was a response to the government saying, you know, these massacres are taking place in Colombia because of narco trafficking. I mean, and then that was their explanation. And so you came back, you know, kind of as a riposte. But maybe you'd like to give us a bit of information about what's going on here at the moment.
Yeah, it's extremely difficult to know what's going on. There's still a lot of information we still don't know. So, I mean, in that case, even my analysis will be limited, without a doubt. Unfortunately, what we've seen this month is something 12 or 13 massacres. If you count, you know, three people killed in the same scenario, it's a little less if you only count four and above. But nonetheless, we have 12 or 13 different massacres throughout the country, many focused in the southwest, and especially in the province of Nariño. What has been happening? Like, it's very difficult to come up with one national general narrative, because there's so many different things going on at the same time. And this conflict, in armed violence today in Colombia, organized armed violence, I should say, is extremely local. And it's more and more local, and armed group control is incredibly limited to local scenarios, two or three municipalities sometimes. So to say what exactly is going on is difficult. We definitely have disputes between armed groups. We definitely have cases of governance by armed groups, where they use violence to maintain not a specific role or rules over local populations, which is kind of the heart of that Twitter thread I've written. But then we have cases that we don't know what's happened in San Diego, which is perhaps the most visible massacre, where there's seven or eight people who are, you know, in their 20s, basically together having a good time, were killed. That case, there is still no consensus whatsoever on even a first hypothesis of what has happened there. So, unfortunately, the situation is one of extreme violence, but also quite a bit of confusion. And trying to organize all these ideas and organize all these different dynamics is definitely challenging.
I mean, if we take that, the massacre, and it was a massacre, and of course the detail, as you said, you know, a massacre is the context is three or more killings in one place, I think, is what it's taken as. But this one in San Diego, these are eight, you know, university age or school leaver age kids. And, you know, they were just sort of picked at random, it seems, from a farm. I mean, I guess it's like a holiday house outside of San Diego. They were just, and you know, the hypothesis, as you said, the authorities are saying it was the ELN, but these guys did, you know, the ELN don't come up in those cars that we've seen, and they don't operate in this way. I'm not defending the ELN, you know, it has. And then there's the whole, I read a whole thing of it's the Mexicanization of Colombia. This is the cartels, which I found very hard to believe in that perspective there. And then I thought, well, is it just, I mean, is it one of the newly armed groups, GAOs, or whatever they call themselves, or is one of them trying to instill so much fear to in order to have the authority of the region? I mean, I just don't know.
Yeah, it was extremely difficult. I mean, at first there was, the idea came about that it was the ALN, just because this is an area that historically has been under ELN control and for decades, even more so than the FARC. So that was obviously kind of everyone's first guess. This is not common for the ELN. The ELN carries out massacres. They definitely do. In the case when they're in an armed dispute with another armed group, they carried one out in Nariño in 2017 and Chocó, I think it was maybe 2017 as well as 2018. I don't remember exactly. Supposedly in Catatumbo in 2018. But there's no dispute with the ELN in San Diego.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, the kind of logic falls apart. And so there was an idea maybe this has to do with COVID because the CLN had put out some pamphlets about COVID in April, but then again, that fell apart. And now the Fiscalía and the Attorney General and the armed forces have come up with a hypothesis that this is an internal fight between inside a very local drug trafficking organization. And that the massacre, according to them, was targeted at three or four members of this organization, and then they just shot at the witness. Huh. Nonetheless, this kind of there's a big gap in this theory in that there seems to be a consensus beyond the community and the other victims themselves that no one at the party fits this profile of having belonged to a drug trafficking organization. The community denies it. Obviously, the victims deny it. The argument from the Fiscalía is you expect that, but other even state institutions have acted that said, we've got nothing on these. So that's why we're still so much in the dark. And San Diego being a place, like I said, where there's been conflict, but also not just high levels of violence like that we see elsewhere, it's a bit atypical. And so that's what's made it so difficult. And yeah, reading a bunch of the hypotheses, Mexican cartels was a hypothesis. Mexican cartels don't do this type of thing. They hire and finance Colombian groups to do this type of thing. And so that kind of goes out the window. It doesn't mean there are no Mexican cartels or Mexican cartel influence, I think is the correct word, in Nariño, but it just means they're not going to do this. And also, I think if this gets really technical, but a confounding matter is also the types of weapons used.
Yeah.
These kind of more handguns is very rare for massacres in Colombia. So another element, another detail that throws us off course in this case of San Diego.
It's horrible. In the press, you say there's around eight at the moment, but as you say, there's some that have been unreported and maybe 12, 13 in the last few weeks. But why now? I mean, that's the big question. I get the feeling, I've been here a long time, that massacres have taken place throughout. There are massacres in Colombia. There are a lot of massacres. Is it because there's a greater transparency going on that we're seeing the massacres, that they're being reported? Or, I mean, why now are we seeing so many?
That's kind of the magic question. It's especially difficult to answer with all of these different dynamics going on at the same time. I mean, if we look at the case of Tumaco, which along the road between Tumaco and Pasto this month has had at least two massacres and the disappearance of five people, but I can't remember if their bodies have been found yet, but they're presumed dead, all in one month. And this is all about one local conflict between two armed groups, one FARC dissident group and the drug trafficking group, who've been fighting again since March. And all of a sudden, this fighting and tension has been building and building, and the violence has been getting worse and worse. And so now we have this point where it's just massacre after massacre after massacre. Actually, like almost a dialogue of one going back and forth between the groups. The same thing in Cauca, there was a massacre as part of a conflict that's been building and building and building since earlier this year. So that's one element to it of kind of this unfortunate intensification of violence in these areas on a local level. But that would only explain maybe half of the massacres this month. About half, let's say half, keep it easy. Then on the other half, we have those where we don't know what happened, like the one in Andes last night in Antioquia, where it happened yesterday. So San Diego, which I mentioned, Recaute, Nariño, we also don't know what happened there really as well. But also in Cali, the massacre of the five adolescents, teenagers basically. Who unfortunately the hypothesis that has been coming out today is that they were massacred because they had been continually going in and eating the sugar cane in that area. And so if that is true, that is a bit insane in terms of a reason to kill teenagers. But at the same time in Arauca, there was a massacre of five people who a FARC dissident group accused them. Well, no. The FARC dissident group accused them of stealing cattle, of robbing cattle, after some local residents had made the accusation that these people were stealing cattle. And so here there's no dispute. Mm-hmm. Here's a whole different story. Here's just a local dynamic where the rules for social life and the rules of everyday social interaction, political interaction, economic activity are put in place by the ELN and the FARC visiting group. And those rules are enforced by the ELN and the FARC visiting group. And here we have an example of that, which unfortunately ended up being extremely violent. This is not new in Arauca by any sense of the word, unfortunately. But it seems like there should be one single explanation for why now, why August 2020. I wish I had it, yeah. Because I would feel like that would be very useful to make sure this doesn't happen again. But I don't. No. So it's very difficult to know.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about the sort of law and order being meted out by the FARC dissidents or the ELN, well, I mean, we know that in a lot of these areas, and that's the lack of institutional or state presence, and that's that's unfortunately the way things have been. And I always end up, and I end up in a lot of these conversations when we discuss things of this nature, not too many of them, but, and I just think, why then, and this is another huge question for you, when the peace accords with the FARC were signed and, the process is sort of, coming into its own, and we got all those amazing images of the FARC coming out of the jungles, to go to their, what they were called at the time, the reintegration or the demobilization camps or whatever it was called. Why didn't the state move in? Why didn't the military move in? But I mean, the answer always. Why not?
Exactly. And this is not the first time this happened. If we jog our memories and go to the AEC demobilization in 2003 and 2006, soon after, there was something like 37 different AUC little hereditary groups that ended up coming down to 3 or 4 or whatever. And the same question was, why did the state do this? And then now, unfortunately, 15 years later, more or less, we're in the same spot with the same question. And it's another one of those million-dollar questions. I really wish I knew. It's been one that I've been rattling around. Well, it's been one that I've had a lot of discussions with different people about this. So anything I say is not just, the result of those discussions. I think part of it is, there's not really an institutional interest for the armed forces to do so at the time. Resolving the conflict, I think, is, brings the army back to their kind of traditional role of protecting the border. And I think at the time, we didn't really predict what was going to happen at the border that's happening now.
Yeah.
And so there would be resistance to that, and that, I think part of the armed forces resisted the idea that, now we can go win the war. The argument was, the armed forces won this war because of them. We can negotiate. Part of the armed forces didn't buy into that and wasn't going to buy into the whole peace process. It wasn't going to buy into that. There was a huge division in the army, and I think it still exists today. I think that may have been a side effect of those divisions. At the same time, I think there's also a quality of planning and actual strategy. So we did have strategies. Remember the victory plan, and then Plan Horus, and then Plan Horus Plus, or whatever it was called. And those were great PowerPoint presentations, but for some reason did not come to life. And I remember being in Miraflores, Guaviare. This was like in 2017, and going out to a corregimiento. And this corregimiento was known for being under control of the FARC dissidents. And I got to the army roadblock leading the town, and, We had a bit of a discussion, just talking back and forth, chatting at 5:30 in the morning for some reason. And I asked them, so when was the last time you guys are telling me this area is under control of this FARC dissident group and they live there and everything? When was the last time you guys went there? And he told me that it was in November and we were speaking in April. So it had been 6 months since they had patrolled, and he told me that they patrolled and nothing happened, so they just came back. And I thought, you patrolled and nothing happened. That's a perfect time to go there and something permanent. But it seemed like the strategy was stuck in this counterinsurgency strategy of 2005, 2010, whatever. I go, I patrol, I come back, end of story. I think that's also a difficulty. And I guess finally, one of the last reasons why it didn't happen is there is still a bit of corruption on the local level.
Yeah.
And you see it quite a bit, unfortunately. And I think armed forces of any, have actually all the actors in the armed conflict are probably the actor that most has kept their ideology. And so their interest focus is more on the ELN. They're shifted towards the ELN. And they were a bit more willing to be corrupt regarding drug trafficking, which is where far dissident groups kind of, you know, have a lot of their activities. And so I think that corruption on a local level doesn't help. I don't think it's a huge determining factor, but it definitely doesn't help. Mm.
I mean, just it's so complex in that, especially if you've got, let's say, the military not prepared to change their doctrine to accept a different, you know, let's say, a platform from which to work. I mean, that's the truth. But what about, I mean, you read in the press, and I think it's the editors, you know, maybe editors back at the desks in the US and the UK who put these phrases in. I hope it's not the journalists here in country doing the reporting saying, you know, this is a return to the bad old days. It's not a return to the bad old days, is it?
No, not at all. And actually, just very quickly, oddly enough, before answering that or talking about that, the military actually did a very huge reform to its doctrine towards the end of the peace agreement. Came out with a whole new series of documents, one after another, about what they were going to do for this plan between 2020 and 2030. Hmm. I have no idea what happened to that, but I know it exists, and it seems like probably a relic of the moment of kind of these pro-peace military guys designing policy, and now the quote-unquote anti-peace, to grossly simplify things, that have come into power and have little oversight by the government. I've probably just kind of thrown that by the wayside. But getting back to the other question, no, we're definitely not back to the terrible days of before, and for two reasons. One, I mean, if you remember what it was like 15 years ago, it was a whole different ballgame. The number of massacres was much higher, level of violence, indicators across the board were much, much higher. Even if the trend was a decrease, still the absolute numbers were much, much higher. I mean, I remember the first time I came to Colombia was the same time the FARC put a Chiva bomb in the center of Toribio in Cauca. It was a massive, massive bomb. This was a huge news story at the time. Mm. That doesn't happen anymore.
No.
I mean, Toribio unfortunately suffers violence, but those kind of things don't happen anymore. And at the same time, there's this idea that the massacres are back. They never went away.
Mm.
And unfortunately, they never went away. Their numbers were much less. 2016, 2017, 2018, these numbers were extremely low. Unfortunately, these numbers have been increasing under Duque, but they never left. And that kind of is an argument, more of a personally annoying argument, just because, you know, working in researching the conflict and researching violence, you see the massacres never left, and you know, interviewed family members of victims and things like that. And so it's kind of annoying when someone says this phenomenon has gone away, but personally, you know, it hasn't. And so that's more of a personal reaction to it, but definitely it has. We're nowhere near what this was 15 years or 10 years ago, even.
No.
Nowhere near that.
It's one of those things that you mentioned. I mean, you brought in the under Duque and so on, and of course we know and that great article by John Lee Anderson from a few weeks ago, and talking about the one period of time where he felt Colombians had hope was that period sort of after the agreement and before the referendum, when people were just, you know, there was a feeling of hope. But for how long? I mean, we're in 2 years now, almost exactly, a bit longer into President Duque's tenure. How long can he keep on blaming his predecessor for the massacres? Because that seems to be his line.
I mean, for me, he can't. I mean, if you're a four-year president, because now, you know, Colombian law has gone back to the previous presidential model that you only have 4 years.
Yeah.
You're halfway through. At one point, my question is, if halfway through, you're still saying this is the guy before me's fault. At what point does your presidency begin? Mm. Being quite frank about it. I think at the same time, you win an election knowing the conditions of the country that you're receiving, quote unquote. And so there's that element to it of okay, so at what point are you going to say, I'm going to step up? I knew this situation was occurring before I came into power. I knew it when I came into power. I know it now. You've got to respond. At the same time, there's an argument. This is also part of the argument that this is all because of drug trafficking. Because the idea behind Duque's argument is that coca increased under Santos, so violence is increasing now. The weird thing that Duque cannot explain is how coca increased under Santos, but violence decreased at the same time.
Yeah.
That is something that is very difficult to explain, and how the interesting thing about Duque is the last 2 years in power, they've been bragging about decreases, albeit slight decreases, to be honest, in coca production, not cocaine production, coca production, and hectares, but at the same time, an increase in violence. So that just the simple relationship that the government is proposing and Duque is proposing doesn't really add up. Never mind getting into the whole other issues of, you know, local governance, state weakness, institutional weakness, and all these other issues of kind of the structural side of things, and the fact that the drug trade is also an effect of these structural conditions. Just looking at the very simple argument of things, it doesn't add up. And when you're 2 years into your presidency, still blaming the guy before you, it's kind of mind blowing to me how much of this presidency that's left is going to be quote unquote his. Being very frank about that.
Well, I think that's, I mean, you're spot on, and I want to just go back and make sure everybody heard that. One of those elements that you just said there is, you know, under Santos, coca production increased but violence decreased. I mean, it's so interesting to think about that. And of course, yeah, the current government lauds the fact that that they've seen it's a marginal decrease in coca production. It's kind of a whack-a-mole, though, because they're hitting one thing and the next thing. But, you know, this brings us to the main point, is that, you know, when we're talking about the massacres and we're talking about the violence in the countryside, and it's never gone away, let's be honest about it, but that the government's sort of fix all solution is to say, well, it's narco trafficking, so therefore we must fumigate. I mean, and that's going to get rid of all the problems. And that's what you alluded to totally in your thread on Twitter. This is not taking into account the massive nature of the narcotics trade and how it permeates every single level. It's an industry. You know, fumigating the crop is not going to finish it.
No, not at all. I mean, the evidence, I mean, there's overwhelming evidence and almost an academic consensus that fumigation is the worst way to try to get rid of coca, which is also based on another assumption in that the best way to fight drugs is to get rid of coca, which is also not true. So there's a whole kind of series of terrible arguments behind a lot of this. I think the first one is that this is all because of the drug trade. And I think we need to have a discussion, even amongst analysts and researchers, like our little community, journalists, kind of our community, but also Colombian society in general. Really, what is the limit? What is the actual role of the drug trade in all of this? There is a role. Mm. We know that, without a doubt. But that role has a limit. It's not everything. I had a debate with someone on Twitter about this as well, and I think the key is the drug trade definitely, I think, has two roles that were very safe and secure and mentioned. One, they finance the arms groups, without a doubt. I mean, all arms groups make money off the drug trade. They need money to survive. I mean, they're no different than any other government, and they're no different from any other armed groups or from any other criminal activity. You need money to survive. At the same time, the drug trade is also the motivation. The control of the drug trade is often the motivation for some of these groups. I wouldn't say all of them, without a doubt, but it's definitely, for many of them, it is. And I think there, I feel comfortable saying, categorically, we could say that. Because even the idea that controlling the drug trade automatically gives you territorial control over people's lives, I don't think is true. I think that's what happens, but it doesn't happen all the time. There are numerous large drug groups in Colombia, drug trafficking organizations in Colombia, who don't control people's lives. The government calls them GDOs, so what was called La Constru in Putumayo, which is a local drug trafficking organization, or La Cordillera, and basically Eje Cafetero, which is kind of weird to talk about Eje Cafetero and all this, but they're there as well, including the Puntilleros in the Eastern Plains. They have a key role in the drug trade. They make a lot of money off the drug trade, but they just have no role in controlling people's day-to-day lives. And so even that, there's limitations to that. And so for me, there's also a limitation into how does a drug trade produce violence. We know that statistically, municipalities with coca are more violent than municipalities without coca. The question is that causal? I would argue partially, because also municipalities with coca suffer from all the same structural problems that lead to violence, like insufficient state presence, which armed groups can then fill that gap. And while the municipalities without Cuca have stronger institutional presence, and so social conflicts maybe are more likely to be resolved through the judicial system. And that doesn't happen in Cuca-growing municipalities. So I think there's even more elements to it. I think there's a causal aspect there from the drug trade, but I think it may be reflective of other issues at the same time. And I think finally, there's a lot of municipalities with a lot of coca and very little violence, and that's very hard to explain if your argument is drug trafficking leads to violence. That's often because there's not more than one group fighting over that place at that time. Of course, the drug trade and food, is an influence or has a role in that fight over the municipality. But if no one's fighting over it, it's not just like there's coca here, and so whoever runs this is just going to kill everyone. No, it's weird, but that's not what happens. The violence that's inherent in the drug trade is because there's no regulatory agency in there, and so might kind of wins out. But that doesn't necessarily affect the civilian population, as weird as that sounds. It can, obviously, but it doesn't have to. But I think at the same time, there's another factor that is a temporal factor. Municipalities with a lot of coca over time will see the violence then go up and down drastically, while the coca levers are more or less stable. That's also very difficult to explain if we're only looking at coca. Nonetheless, all these gaps, argumentative gaps that's thrown on the table, doesn't mean I have the answer.
No.
So I could put out an answer and say, I think this is more related to governance gaps in governance by the state or other legal actors that are filled by illegal armed groups, and that includes the drug trade but goes beyond the drug trade. And I think that's an element of it, but again, I think that also misses a lot of the dynamics of what's happening, and we're seeing that now with the massacres, like in San Diego, we don't know what's happened there, or in Andes and Antioquia, where you don't see a whole huge issue, this issue of the drug trade dominating people's lives. And even in Nariño, in the Cauca state, Nariño as well, we don't know what's happened there. So even then, recognizing that I've got another way of looking at things, which is ideas that come from, if anyone wants to look into them, I highly recommend Gustavo Roncon and his work. So I think he's covered it. He's just explained it the best. I've really just kind of taken hint of ideas, added my own little things to it, and then just went out to do field work to see if this is true. But even then, there's limitations to that argument as well. So it's extremely complex. And to think that anything like, mass violence can just be explained by one factor, which can then just be blown away with a series of airplanes, flying over the countryside, which don't necessarily kill coca and also make people hate this government even more. It's just kind of, which foot do you want to shoot yourself in? It's kind of how I look at it.
Well, I'll say it. You don't have to say it. This government's incredibly good at doing that, shooting itself in the foot. If it's not, former Minister Botero, if it's not the Vice President Marta Lucia Ramirez, if it's not the President himself, they're doing pretty well,
I haven't recognized that as something they were excelling in.
That's the one thing. I have to ask you these, and they're kind of follow-on questions on an international perspective, as your thoughts on this, the coca paste production up there in Holland that was recently found. Have you read about that?
I've only heard about it. I haven't read I don't know the details or anything.
Yeah, something like 13 Colombians captured as well in the raid, So it's totally connected. There's no.
But were they making coca paste or turning coca paste into cocaine?
I think it was coca paste into cocaine there in Holland.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
There's some very interesting studies on drug trafficking networks of Colombians in Holland. Oddly enough, it seems like a really niche thing to study, but but it's quite interesting. But also, I have to say, in years past, I remember doing research at the Corporación Nuevo Arcoíris in his time. And one thing that we had found was exportation of coca paste even to West Africa and other places where the cocaine the transformation of coca paste to cocaine was happening closer to the sales market. And we had interpreted that as a bit of a risk control or risk reduction strategy. if I lose a ton of cocaine as a drug trafficker, that's a lot of money gone. If I lose a ton of coca paste as a drug trafficker, that's not as much money gone. I don't know how common that is these days. Most of the busts off of the Pacific Coast are still cocaine.
Yeah.
And the labs are still there. And going through Venezuela, routes that go through Venezuela definitely are more coca paste than cocaine. But going into Venezuela, so when it crosses the border, it's much more coca paste than cocaine. And normally those cocaine laboratories have been close to the border. I don't know if that's still the case, or this has been changing as things in Venezuela change so drastically and so rapidly. I should, you know, that would be good to look into. But historically, any of that along the borders, even in close to Putumayo, it was very common for coca base to be crossed into Ecuador, then turned into cocaine, and then sent to the market. But so, I mean, this, it's not new, but it's a ballsy strategy. I mean, plus the logistics to send cocaine onto the international market are not small, not few. And so, do that with coca paste. You really gotta be sure that this is worth it. You know,
definitely.
This is a strong euro compared to the peso.
Given the peso right now, I have to bring it to this, and as we wind this down, I have to bring it to this, unfortunately, but you know, we've got President Trump in power up there in your homeland, and of course his you're from Connecticut, you can't get away from it.
No, I can't.
You know, you got President Trump in power, and his thing is, you know, cut the supply, and the demand will drop off, and you know, without it, which we all know about, and we've kind of discussed it. And should he win again, November? I mean, if we wake up on November 3rd and he's still in power, I suspect more of the same. You know, more pressure on Colombia to fumigate and so on. I would assume, as my best guess, that fumigation will start sooner rather than later. I get this feeling that that's going to happen.
Yeah.
If Joe Biden is elected in on November 3rd, are we going to see a change in policy, a change in attitudes towards Colombia?
It's possible. It's tough to tell because, oddly enough, one of the few things that Congress has been able to maintain some sort of consensus on, whether we agree with them or not, is that Plan Colombia was a big success and support to Colombia must continue. Exactly. Again, whether we agree with them or not is another issue, you know, but this is a consensus that exists in Washington. And even the idea that came out this week of the quote-unquote simplified view, but the quote-unquote new Plan Colombia, is a question you hear in Washington a lot. Yeah. Why don't we just do another Plan Colombia? How the Biden campaign understands that Plan Colombia is going to be telling. Whether it will, I'm going to make a guess here. It's an educated guess.
Yeah.
And it's risky, but I'm going to say, I think if Biden comes to power, fumigation will probably stop.
Okay.
Because I think there's a consensus under Democrats that this is a waste of time and money. And the development side of things is a more promising approach. And this because of the congressional Democrats, at least in the House, recently voted basically saying just that. And so if that's the case, that program could stop fairly quickly. It also depends on financing, like who's financing what, and then budget debates and all that. How much pressure that Congress is going to play a key role as well, because budgets go through Congress, and how much pressure and who ends up with what? Do we have a Democratic-dominated Congress, or is it split? How much pressure could the Democrats take? They're not known for being able to handle political pressure very well, let's say. So how much pressure can they take vis-a-vis a more hardened approach from the Republicans on this issue will remain to see. But nonetheless, I think I would venture out to say that. Now, would it be immediate? It wouldn't be something most Spanish. Once he comes to power, things will change. But during his 4 years, I think we can. I think we'll see that.
Well, that's, you know, I mean, we can, but hope that there is a renewed look at Colombia. Let's say either party that look at it maybe through a different, you know, different set of glasses at Colombia would be what I would hope for, but who knows? I mean, Colombia's yeah. Colombia, and we're here. So, and finally then, because this has been really interesting, and I know my listeners have enjoyed this, definitely, because we've gone, again, beyond what can be printed due to word limits and so on, and what editors behind desks are want, and to sell newspapers and magazines. I want to know, I mean, how do you feel that as we come back to the original question about the massacres, how do you feel that this is all going to develop in coming months? As we see out 2020, is it just going to be another massacre after massacre, unfortunately?
I don't think we'll see massacres at the same rhythm that we've seen them, but we'll definitely continue to see them. I mean, it's the political pressure on armed groups to not commit massacres really is effective on a local level, and the people who are able to actually have an opinion on this and say it openly live in Bogota or in the big cities and places that aren't affected by this. And so that political pressure is limited, unfortunately. At the same time, the government policy of it, of this new unit that will investigate and provide, you know, payments for whoever has information, and then to come up with a cartel of the most wanted massacrists, if that's a word, is not going to have much of an effect.
No.
So, unfortunately, I think our best hope in we have kind of two things that'll be decisive, I guess to say. One is, will these disputes on a local level continue? Will these institutional gaps start to be filled in some way? And then secondly, will local communities and will people who are suffering these violence be able to resist and push back enough with, you know, outside accompaniment, with outside support, but at the same time in a COVID crisis, to at least minimize the violence in some way and create kind of a pushback that, you know, if the armed groups are here and you're in a fight, just don't, literally, you know, just don't massacre people. And it sounds very basic, but it's extremely difficult, especially for these local communities and especially, like I said, in the COVID crisis. But I think that my best hope to kind of maybe slow the levels of violence, the low level of violence for the next 4 months in the year, I think I put that in the local communities, their organizations, their ability to resist and to organize more than anything. Luckily, Colombia has a history of a lot of communities who can do just that.
Yeah.
And so hopefully that can come about. But at the same time, I think we should have realistic expectations. This is not going to be resolved in the short term. Even the peace agreement has a 15-year timeline, and I think that's a generous. So this is not going to be resolved in the short term. Hopefully we can just find a way to, even if, you know, the drug trade continues, even if these structural conditions continue, as a result, in the long term, at least minimize violence in the short term. I think if we can kind of create a narrative that allows for new policy, new thinking and policy and support for local communities, I think that would be great. And even with that, it'll still be a long term issue.
Yeah. Well, you know, wow, that's awesome. I always cringe a little bit when I see, you know, the president getting up there and just saying, oh, well, you know, I've ordered the armed forces to send another division, which will be the rapid response division, and we'll find the people guilty. Well, you know, finding the guys that pulled the trigger is one thing, but it's finding and getting the people who sent down the order to pull the trigger is another thing altogether.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
completely. And that's the case of Cali. If Cali is an issue of literally kids going to eat sugar cane, and, you know, the newspaper is saying, I mean, this is news from today, so who knows if this will be true tomorrow, saying that, you know, the possible security guards were in on this. Well, there's people behind them as well. That's a perfect case of, we may know who the trigger people are, at least two of the trigger people, alleged trigger people, will capture today. But there's a lot of people behind that.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And if we don't start on, you know, turning over those stones and getting progress there, it's gonna be very difficult to make these changes. Yeah, completely agree.
Well, listen, thank you so much for your time and your knowledge, which you shared so unselfishly. You know, you really have given it out, and hopefully we've been able to fill in some of the gaps or actually provide you with further questions to the listeners out there about what's going on in Colombia.
Probably that.
Yeah, and I promise, Kyle, next time we'll get you on to talk about something much, much lighter, and you can, you know, we can leave the conversation smiling and feeling upbeat. But I think that given what has been going on in the last few weeks here in Colombia, this is, you know, of great importance to try and get a little bit more information out there about what is going on and why is this happening, or at least, you know, give our best guess. And you're, of course, academically and on the ground, your knowledge, having traveled and been in all these places, is second to none. So, of course, can people check out your new entity that you've created, Core? Have you got a website up?
We haven't got a website. We're that new.
Wow.
We haven't even got. We created the organization about 2 months ago.
Okay.
When a project came up, and in order to receive funds for the project, we had to create the NGO, and then it kind of snowballed. It's very new, but still, we don't even have Twitter, an official Twitter for Core. Actually, we were very unprepared for all of this in August. We were thinking of doing behind the scenes planning, and then all of a sudden, unfortunately, things changed. But you can find me on Twitter. I also have a colleague on Twitter who is Juanita Velez. She used to work for La Cia. She's a journalist, a great journalist. And there's another colleague who is will still remain anonymous for now.
Okay.
But we'll be out and continue doing our work, and hopefully be traveling around a bit as well.
Well, excellent. Well, one of these days we'll meet in person and, of course, and discuss these things over a coffee or a beer. Anyway, so look up the Twitter accounts for Juanita Velez and, of course, for Kyle Johnson, and follow them for up to the day news and, let's say, feedback, really, and information about what's going on. So more than just the news, it's beyond that. It will go into, you know, an explanation of why, what, when, why, where, and so on. So, of course, tune into those things. And as soon as he's got a website up for the Conflict Responses Foundation, we will post it on the Facebook page so you can look at it there too. Let me take this moment to say thank you so much for your time, Kyle Johnson. It really has been very interesting indeed. And of course, you've actually, you know, I think I'm left with a few more questions, but I'm not going to ask them. I know that my listeners have enjoyed this. So again, my hat goes off to you for all the work that you've done and the traveling that you do as well around the country to get this information. And yeah, well, let's get you back on sometime in the future during more upbeat times.
That sounds great, and thank you for the invitation, and anything that can be of help, more than a pleasure.
All right. Well, thank you again, everyone out there who's been listening to this episode 340 of the Colombia Calling podcast. I've been Richard McColl talking to Kyle Johnson. I'm here in Mompox. I'm 6 hours south of Cartagena. Johnson's in Colombia. We're not allowed to give you his location. We'll be back next week with further people talking about something Colombia related or through the lens that is Colombia. Thank you again for listening. Bye-bye.